Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Fred.
We're
still locked down.
I know. We're still in our separate homes, like we always are. So it really isn't affecting the way we do our recording, because you're in Colorado, I'm in California. It would be cool if we could get together and record, but logistically, and this just works. We walk into our microphone and we do it. But one of the things, and we were talking before we're getting going here about current events and all this stuff, and this idea of testing, right? And there's data. You were talking about Colorado State has, the state government has reportings of hospitalizations and this and that. And then I don't think it's the CDC. Diane's been following some other charts that show cumulative. The Wall Street Journal shows number of total cases. And you brought up a really interesting point that applies back to reliability work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever been involved with a group that wanted to do or was doing reliability growth testing?
No, I know that Dwayne, the Dwayne's reliability growth curve
And it's a cumulative model, right?
As I understand it, and my experience has been that the reliability growth curve or the reliability growth has been mostly a government contracting world.
Software.
Maybe I've seen it. I haven't personally. Okay. In the many companies I've consulted with, they don't have a reliability growth. That's usually done during product development.
Right. And so but it's one example I can think of that uses cumulative failures. I also saw it in maintenance world, right? We track cumulative failures over a period of time, or cumulative repair actions, or cumulative downing actions, or stuff like that. And you're just basically counting cumulatively how many times the equipment goes down, and then over time. And just that plot, it's called a mean cumulative plot. If it's curving up, I mean, it's like my car when I was a teenager, right? It was first the muffler, then the U-joints, and then this, and then the gas tank plugged up. And the number of repairs were increasing in frequency, so that curve indicated that, right? It was very, very clear.
Right.
As opposed to something, what reliability growth is supposed to do is in development is you build test fix, right? You run some testing, you do some stuff, you find some failures, you go fix them. And you test again, and now you find some other failures, and then you fix them, and then you find it's harder to find more failures because you just have fewer left to find, is kind of the theory, right? And so that curve will flatten out, but it won't go down because it's a cumulative count,
right?
But it brings up this other notion of, well, we do all kinds of testing, right? In reliability world, and one of the things you and I have talked about a couple of times was with halt testing, we'll find something, right? And the first response, you and I, we know we're going to get it. We take it back to the engineer. Doesn't matter what discipline they're in. And they look at it and go, well, of course it broke. You hit it with too big of a hammer.
Right.
You had too much stress. Right. You did this.
You overstressed
that.
It.
Yeah. Right. So
you caused it to break.
Right. And so they're looking at the results and going, well, they're not really meaningful. But if you come back to them, and you and I have talked about this, is we go to that engineer and say, here's this type of failure. If we apply this stress, this underlying failure mechanism, like a metal fatigue, right,
is
bending back and forth under vibration, and it cracks and falls off. If I do that at normal stresses, it just will take longer, but we'll get the exact same phenomena, right? We can talk to it through the details of what actually failed and bring in the failure analysis and bring an understanding of it. The hard part is if we're looking at an overall system, right, we're bringing a new complex product to market and we're seeing failures and let's use a hypothetical, right? Let's say you want to say, hey, let's do halt testing early in the program as a way to avoid finding these issues in our normal testing late in the program and then delaying the program, for example.
Well, that's a normal strategy of HALT, is early in the development.
Right.
Piece parts or subsystems. Yeah.
But how do you tell them, so it combines with that we're going to find stuff early on, and then they're going to say, well, that's an early prototype. It's not robust, or that's an irrelevant failure. We're not going to fix that. And how do you?
Well, that might be, but you first have to find it. But what, first of all, if you're just using one sample and you find something, yes, you don't really know unless you had a previous similar product before and you had already had HALT results before with a predecessor product, mm-hmm. or a very similar type structure or thing, mm-hmm. that you had some comparison. I wrote, you know, I write, this is one of my chapters, this comparative limit analysis that mm-hmm. you have to, even with three samples, if you have two that go to 90 degrees or 120 degrees or around there, and you have one that goes to 85, then you have something to study. And then you can say, in this population, you've got to have more than one. I mean, when people ask me, can you do a HALT test with one sample? I said, not really. You know, you're really not going to be able to, you can do some HALT, but, you know, first of all, they say, well, we can't break it.
We got one sample. So you get one sample, you can't break it. So not really. No, you can't do that. No, but I've had experiences where you go into HALT and the first sample just does all kinds of weird stuff and you learn tons of stuff. And then, yeah, I have a second sample so I can keep going while I'm in the lab. And I often find, or I shield from the failures we've already identified and then try to find more stuff. But
well, then you're finding all design type failures.
Oh, yeah.
Design mark issues, not manufacturing issues.
No,
you can also find bad solder joints and things mm-hmm. that also have a different, but until you find those things, you can't do anything or make any statement about them.
Right.
And that's the problem. People don't find anything. Stop.
But you found that, and what I'm getting at here is that in many cases, it's how we present the information. So let's say we have a spike in field failure rates for, we don't know why. We got 47 calls on Friday afternoon and we would normally expect two or three, for example.
Right.
What's going on? Right. Do you just say, hey, the sky is falling, or this is an issue, we got to solve this? Or is it just like, well, we don't know yet, we got to go investigate it? Or do you say, you know, the 8,000 other products are all doing just fine, so let's not worry about it. It's
right.
So you can see you can spin it all kinds of different ways.
Sure. And the way to look at it is the rate, the change is basically the change in time of the failure rates. If they suddenly start to spike and go up, then yes, you've got a significant new introduced issue, whether it be that somebody applied and used your product in a different application that hadn't been used before, and they're coming all back from that, or are you having a high spike from that new, you know, not known by the company mm-hmm. use of that product, or you've had a manufacturing flaw that's been introduced, maybe a component with a latent defect in it, and so you know, that may say somebody who using MTBF didn't see, you know, the average failure rate is still about the same. They wouldn't be alarmed if you looked at the rate of change.
You're just poking me now on the MTBF.
You're
just doing that on purpose. Yeah.
Well, I'm encouraging people to go to nomtbf.com.
Meanwhile, there you go.
To see why you don't even use MTBF. But anyway, this is that's a deceptive. You know that.
Well, I get what you're saying, but if let's say every Friday for the last 3 months we've had one failure. Right.
Yes.
Reported. And it's just kind of in the realm of like 1, 2, 3 failures per day or per week. And then this one day we get 6. Now, here's the rub is I agree with everything you said is it's worth understanding what's going on. But when do I trigger that? Do I go into my boss and say, hey, we had a doubling of our expected failure rate? Or if I use one as the average and I say we have 6, we have a 600% increase in failures. You know, and if we're shipping thousands of units,
right? That may not matter.
I mean, but if we go from 1% to 6% or 0.1% to 0.6%, there's still a big jump. It doesn't matter what scale you're on. It's a step function, right?
Right.
And so, but is it worth investigating if it's six out of a, if it's only 60 units we've ever shipped and we've got six of them, 10% have failed on this one day, reported on that one day, that's a completely different story. Mm-hmm. And then if we have 6 million units out there and we had, you know, six extra units fail.
Yeah.
So it's in context.
Well, there'd be a lot of data that would go, you know, are they close together in serial number? Are they coming from the same look? I mean, those would trigger some investigation into looking at, possible correlations with, you know, some use, some customer, some serial number, getting them back, of course, mm-hmm, and finding mm-hmm. out what the root cause was and what the failure mechanism is absolutely the fundamentals of addressing the problem. You know, whether now there's so many products, it's very hard to get an inexpensive $50 products. Probably not going to come away. Back to use.
I know.
Yeah.
But it's not the point of doing the failure analysis. I don't think anybody, and I certainly don't disagree, is that when we... But it's more how do we set the trigger that if a doubling of our failure rate is that the way to present it? Hey, we only usually get one, and now we have two. Is that worth triggering it, or do we use like a control? Right, we doubled the failure rate, but if it's 0.01% versus 0.02%.
Right.
Is it
doubling a very small number? Doesn't make
it's still a very small number? Yeah.
Number, right.
And if we go from 0 to 1, it's, you know, we've gone through the roof. So,
right.
The hard part is well, if we go in and say, hey, it doubled, that's a whole different context than saying, hey, within the normal variation we get, we're on the high end of that. Right. And I'm thinking of control chart. Right. If you really want to get into it and you're doing a regular routines like this, you look for those out of control or unusual activities that suggest there's a shift or a change or something like that.
Right. That's what SBC is about.
Right. But I have almost never seen that in field returns and even in product development processes, because it's so hard to do a control chart when you have the denominator is always changing. You different number of shipments you're making, different number of prototypes available, different number of test sequences that are being run. Just tracking the total number of failures is a way to do that, but it's not a great way because everything else is changing. And so how do you, what the idea is, it's not what we do after we get the alert, is how do you set triggers within an organization so that we can detect false positives or false negatives clearly? When does it the information presented so that it's clear that, we need to take action versus, no, we just need to monitor? And that's my question, is how do we know when we get a doubling that it's worth doing something?
I think that, you know, obviously that's very product dependent, but it's kind of something that if you're producing, you know, five a week, one is probably too many. But if you're producing 10,000 like they do with phones or, you know, different device consumer devices. First of all, it'd be hard to know exactly those numbers from the field. So that's where, you know, your internal testing or quality monitoring or final test before they leave the factory would be critical. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, you know, what trigger levels are difficult, I guess, would be established based on the price of the product and the reputation of the product and predecessor products, what the failure rates and kind of what the consumer is expecting or tolerates.
Yeah, those are all good. But I think when you get the event, right, when something happens, it's probably not the right time to go set those triggers and discuss it, right? And the one I would add to your list, though, also is what do we know about the failure mechanism, if we know anything, right? Is it, like you said earlier, is it grouped or whatever? What can we get right away to help frame it? But here's the, you know, the
well, that's the most critical information is what's
going on. Yeah.
Right.
So let's say we're doing a test and not halt, but we've got a range of environmental tests, you know, that we say this is going into a, you know, it's going to be outdoors. So we're going to run some UV on it, right? Or it's going to get dust and we don't know how it's going to behave with dust. And so we run some testing and we're doing it near the end of the program for whatever reason. That's pretty common, right? And one of our samples fails because of dust contamination. And we had three units on test, typical environmental, you know, standards say, you know, test a handful of units and do this thing. And they all should pass. And if they don't pass, then you haven't passed this test. Now, I know you've run into this, and I certainly have myself, is where, you know, I have all these 15 units on, some are getting rained on, some are UV, some are dust, some are this, some are vibration. Right. And we get one or two failures. And we're 2 weeks away from launching production, right? And starting to ramp up. Seriously, and all this money is in place to go do this stuff. And the program manager looks at me and says, well, that was just one failure. We can waive that. And I look at him and I go, look, we had one out of three. This test was replicating use conditions. Yeah, worst case, worst use conditions, but it wasn't serious heavy stress. And you have a 30% failure rate. So, and you're okay with that?
That's what's called ATS. You know what that acronym is? Acceptable to ship.
Yeah.
I
30% is okay.
For me to listen to that when, especially in software testing or operating system testing and rebooting and running, and, you know, one every 326 times it would have a blue screen of death or a lockup. And then it would be, well, we only saw that once or twice. And, you know, we don't know what it was caused by. We can't really. So it's ATS.
And sign off on it and move it.
Yeah, exactly. And I go, wait, that's one out of 226. Now, if I took statistically and said one, you know, 126 of your 200 million units, that's a lot of units, folks. And, you know, what percent, you know, and you don't know what is causing it. So you don't know what the variation is. It could be just a slight timing issue that as soon as you make a billion of them or a 100,000 of them, that timing issue,
it's much more prevalent.
A little bit of,
it may
shift your production may cause that timing, your manufacturer may cause that timing shift because there's little information between hardware and software interaction. So that may, you know, but there's a lot of that, Fred.
Well, I know it's ATS I hadn't heard before, but there's a lot of pressure on organizations and teams to get the product out the market and get it going. And, but it's, it's what fascinates me is that we design these tests and it's a hand wave that say, oh, that's a false positive. That was an anomaly of the test. That was your fixture did something to it and made it happen. You're just looking for failures. I heard that one once and I'm like, that's what I'm doing.
That's what I'm here for.
That's what you paid me to do, you know, and I found you failures. Right. Well, don't bring me failures. Bring me solutions. All right. We'll fix this, you know?
Okay. I've seen problems that just keep, you know, I could always go into an 85 degree, 85 percentage, relative humidity. I could put systems into a chamber and I could guarantee that the dim memory slots, one or two of them, would not, not be happy, would be showing errors, missing memory. I would take the dim strip off, clean the edge connectors, put it back in. Bingo. It's fixed. Now.
Until you do it again next week.
And like, you know that the last time that you reported this as a, you know, high severity or some severity level, and you went through all the rigmarole of studying why that happened, and you get back that there was some contaminant on the edge of the connectors that wasn't cleaned properly from the company that produced that particular memory stick. And it's it's the same problem that was the last time.
ATS. Yeah, you just keep seeing it and like, let's fix it, guys. And then,
yeah, well, they'll go back to the company that provided the memory and say, okay, you guys got to clean better. Okay. But I could guarantee that the next time I could either get so.
Well, how many DIMMs were in your system? How many DIMMs were on the failure that you had something failed on? How many were being tested?
2, 3, in there.
Yeah. So
I wouldn't know. Not always. Maybe sometimes I'd fill up the whole memory slot, but I didn't use the maximum, sticks because they were expensive.
Yeah. But if it's 2 or 3 or even 20, you're still like with 20 items and one fail, that's a 5% failure rate. And when I do the simple math like that, well, you need to put a confidence interval on that. All right, it goes from 0 to 6,000. What, come on. We have a failure.
Those are most likely going to be, when they come back to the factory, they're going to be no defect found because either, they'll take out the memory sticks or they just may send the memory stick back. I don't know how they, broke up the product, but it basically is... Fretting corrosion is one of the difficult, contamination on an edge connector or any kind of pin or connector is one of the more difficult failures to actually, discover.
Yeah, definitely.
Just an easy movement of that connector will scrape away enough of the contaminant that's causing, being an insulator, to provide a conduction path again. And there you go. You fixed it.
Yep.
So, the old idea of hitting something
I actually got told that once.
It works.
286 machine. They said, well, just pick up the computer box, the thing. It was a desktop box, big chassis. It says, pick it up about an inch or so off your desk and drop it. What? Yeah, just drop it. And of course it booted right up and it was happy because all the sockets, all this stuff, all the connectors resat, and it worked. And I'm like, it's like my dad when I was growing up. He would turn the TV on and it'd be a little fuzzy, and he whacked the side of the TV. And it was all with vacuum tubes. So it was probably one of the vacuum tubes had a little fretting on it and it reset. It reconnected.
Exactly. It's all you needed. But you can also get, certainly when we've set up test configurations for any kind of test, we've set up something wrong. And that comes back as you're not sure that your test setup caused the failure or you improperly set something up. So that's another way of getting a false positive on a failure.
That's a good point, is if you don't actually vet validate or verify or whatever the right V word is, your test system and your measurement system that you're doing, you could get all kinds of weird signals that are in your test equipment, not in the product. And that's a good point. And I think those are ones that we have to really guard against. Otherwise, we're saying, hey, this has got a real problem here. And then you dig into it. You get the go-ahead to dig into it. They stop production. And you find out, it was just my voltmeter. I was using a 2-point probe instead of a 4-point probe or something like that.
Right, right. And and that's another important thing about doing more than one sample, a minimum really of 3 samples, when you set up, if you're setting it up the same way, you may see these numbers very low or unexpected. There's just a whole bunch of reasons why you need multiple samples. 5 is perfect if you can get at least 5,
I was going to say 500, but that's just
If you do that,
I'm a statistician
again. I say more for halt tests, but 500 for running in a environment would be just ideal. But time schedule pressures,
yeah,
you're never going to get that. Those are all ideal in the testing world, we're always looking for the ideal sample size, and you're never going to get that. No, I mean, rarely.
Rarely, rarely.
So,
all right. Well, let's hand it off to our listeners. And so this conversation is really around, you know, presenting data. And is it best to do cumulative or just focus on the change in rate, or is it whatever it is? And I think the bottom line is that we've got measurement errors, we've got things that actually are not real issues, the false positives, and we have others when that show passing, and it really isn't. The test didn't tell us what we were expecting it to tell us, and we jumped to a conclusion. There's all kinds of variations of these issues, but it mm-hmm. all comes down into how do we frame and talk about the information, the data that we have. How do we convert it to information so that it's useful? And I think that's the key. So in your world, as you're listening to this, if do you have cases of where the way the data is presented either masks some issue or presents it in a way that makes it clear? I mean, I'd love to hear those stories. And so Kirk and I are both available. You can find us on our about pages on Ascendo. We're both on LinkedIn. At least I think you're still on LinkedIn, Kirk.
Yes, very much.
Okay. And or go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can send us a direct message through there, a contact form there. But it's an issue that we all have to deal with and grapple with, and there's a lot of variables involved, including personalities, so we got to deal with it.
But Fred, you've always been certainly focused on one metric and one way of presenting information, and that is MTBF, which has been dominant in this industry of reliability, and as you've pointed out, very misleading and not useful.
Good last day.
To say the least.
Yeah. Let's use that as the farting shot there. I appreciate that, Kirk. All right. We'll talk to you soon, Kirk. Take care.
Okay, Fred. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.